Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you to what I hope will be a very empowering hour. You can watch this program by going to Progressive Radio Network Facebook. Also, I want to give you a few phone numbers because so many people are using their portable listening devices, whether it's a hardline phone or a cell phone or a computer, that we've had to create another number. Please write this down. Monday to Friday, noon to 1, you can dial this number and listen in. It is 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. But most people, we have found from our surveys, listen on the archives. Let me give you that phone number, because this way, no matter where you're at and what time you want to listen, 24/7, you can download up to 5 programs with one call. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Today I'm going to be presenting, after our health and nutrition, the most definitive article ever written anywhere on the science proving that fluoride is a danger and should not be used. It should not be drank. It should not be consumed in a vitamin supplement. It shouldn't be applied to teeth in a dental office. Now, this has been a hotly contested topic for a long time. It is so voluminous, this particular report I'm going to do, that I'm only going to do a part of it. And then I will. It's already posted on PRN.FM or Progressive Radio Network, so you can download it at your convenience. And why is this important? Because many people in this audience are very socially activist conscious, meaning they care about what goes on in their society. And so you could use this article to go into any city council in any place in the world and show the absolute evidence, more than, I believe, 200 footnotes, all from good scientific journals, proving fluoride has never been what we were promised. And from previous reports I've done on fluoride, I've gotten feedback from citizen activists who were able to convince their local community board to get rid of fluoride, defluoridate. So you have a tool you could use in a court of law. You could use this in anywhere. Also, I'm asking the scientists and journalists in this audience, use this material to make your own articles. This is a very dry scientific article. I didn't write this for public consumption as a general article. I wrote it for everyone else to use it, and the quality of science investigative reporting on this, to do newsletters, to do little information pieces, take any part of it you want and share it. All right, that's coming. Then I'm going to take a look at, in a bid for dystonian surveillance power, Facebook is asking big banks for your customer data. Why would you trust them? Why should they have it? Also today, the Senate Democrats, with very few exceptions, are a gang of warmongers. That's according to David Lindorf, and who's yelling this out. I would agree, because they just passed the largest military-industrial complex budget in history. That means that hundreds of thousands of corporate interests and contractors are going to get rich, not because they're fighting terrorism, not because they're defending us, but because they've learned how to play the system. And we suffer when we have the destruction of the American middle class, the working class, the poor class, and because they say we don't have money. But the Democrats line up to give all the money to the Republicans, and so they get this. I'm going to ask you, after I read a little bit of this, to respond to both of those. Also today, I'm going to share from our environmental segment, the Stockholm Resilience Center. Earth is at risk of heading towards a, quote, hothouse Earth state. And this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Now, that's our most august and most respected scientific body, and they're saying, time's up. That is why, starting Well, we started actually almost 6 months ago. But in the next week or two, I'll be going on the road to film the impact of environmental degradation in all of its manifestations all over the world. And for those of you who would like to participate at some level, even helping to line up some of the people and places we're going to be filming down in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, and Florida, and we can use some extra hands on that because our staff is working as diligently as they can, so when I go out, not a moment is wasted. This is a very important documentary. This could be the most important documentary I've ever produced because it literally tells the truth about how close to cataclysmic suffering we are. Not everyone, not all at once, but as you see in California, people's homes are burning, and as of today, the largest fire in California history is nowhere near controlled, and hundreds of homes are being destroyed as we speak. So they got the message. Now, what they do with it is up to them. And the people living where they have no flood insurance and their homes are being flooded, they got the message. I don't think the people in Florida have yet fully comprehended the message, but it's heading now for most of the people living on the coast, both East and West Coast, that it's not going to get better. This is not just one-off episode where the toxic algae, human-made, because of the enormous political clout that some brothers have who own the largest sugar farms in America and have destroyed the Everglades, and all that industrial chemical runoff, all the pesticides, the fertilizers, and the logging industry, all of that has contributed to the massive pollution of Lake Okeechobee, the largest lake in the state, one of the largest lakes in America, and it's now running off. It's overflowing. So the Corps of Engineers opened it up, and one whole canal goes to the East Coast, one goes to the West Coast, and then it's spreading. So bad you can't walk on the beaches. Now, one of the nice things about living in Florida is the weather is great, the people are very nice, in most places they're very low crime, and you have a quality of life. So people who couldn't afford what wealthy people could go to Marco Island in the 1980s and 90s and buy a home for $75,000. Now those homes are worth $1 million, and they all sit on canals. In fact, all of Marco Island, and I was just on Marco Island, I went to see for myself just 3 weeks ago. I was driving up and down the streets of Marco Island and looking at the canals. Just nice little homes, not mansions, not McMansions, just anywhere else in America, they'd just be a regular working class, middle class home. But in their backyard, they have a canal, and they have a boat on that. They take the boat right out into the Gulf of Mexico. Not now. Those canals are oozing with toxic algae. It is in the air, and what you can breathe can adversely affect you. You can't walk on the beaches because they're so toxic. Now, there's a house every inch of the beach from the furthest point on the West Coast and on the East Coast clear up the entire state. So not only do you have storm surges, you have higher, more potent, and more powerful and destructive hurricanes, and the ocean is coming in further at night, eroding the beach, but now you have toxic tides. And it's terrible to see these wonderful mammal sea creatures, manatees in particular. You've had more die since January in the last 5 years. They're suffocating. And so what's being done about it? How about nothing? Zero. Nothing. Except they're playing the denial card, denial of who's responsible. Well, so now, here's the wake-up call. In my opinion, my personal opinion, if you live in Florida, plan on your next move in life. Because it's over. It's over. Nevada, over. California, North and South California, over. New Mexico, over. Arizona, way over. And if you thought that miles-high sandstorm that happened last week, I mean, it looked like out of some movie done like in Saudi Arabia, where you have, as far as you can see up, there's sand, and as far as you can see in the distance, there's sand, and we went through the dust storms in the 1930s, those were bad. A sandstorm's different. Anything that's growing, it destroys. Your car, it'll affect your paint. Your outside, it could hurt you. Your house. Sandstorms are deadly. Now we're seeing multiple sandstorms. For decades, you didn't see one. Now you see two or three in the same year. It's over. That doesn't mean people are going to do a damn thing about it. Probably won't, because we're addicted to our comforts and we're hardwired to want to be where we grew up and people we grew up with, and that's understandable. But be realistic about the environment you live in, because there's no one coming to save you. There's no support system for you. And even the post-crisis support system, like FEMA, is a boondoggle. It is utterly, utterly failed. Sandy, Katrina, Puerto Rico, it fails. So I'm just giving you a heads up. For those of you who are going to move, smart move. Because if you don't sell and move, it's my opinion that within the next, and it'll be based upon the next major hurricane, not the red tide, the hurricane, or the fires, because now we have the worst fires in Florida history in the winter and spring before it rains, when everything's dry, and we have the worst flooding in the summer where it rains every day, and then you have your hurricane. So we just had a Category 4, and it's up to a year, year and a half to get repairs done. What's going to happen when we get a Category 4 again, and or a Category 5? Category 5, you're going to see devastation like we've never seen in American history. Well, how many people are going to stay when there's nothing they can do with their home because insurance is not covering it and they can't afford to repair it? And the quality of life means for the next 3 months, 6 months, a year, you're going to be cleaning up. You're going to move. When that happens, when people start to move en masse, then it'll become a stampede to get out of the state. And then all those people had those beautiful and wonderful communities and gated communities, watch the exodus occur then. And then that means the underlying real estate taxes that support the schools and community services and commons is going to collapse. And when that collapses, then you're not going to see things done that need to be done, even with federal bailouts. Now let's just multiply that times 20 states. And then you start seeing what kind of problem we have. So I'm the person giving you a clarion call. I'm not a Cassandra. I'm not trying to scare people. I'm merely saying, in a responsible and reasonable way, look for the truth, but do not stop with the media, who's been in denial of this and the severity or the causes, or the government, because they're not going to do anything. Obama, Clinton did nothing. And Bush, nothing. And Trump, nothing. So the state's not going to help you. The federal government's not going to help you. The media's not going to be honest with you. So just understand what you're dealing with. Then hopefully you'll make a choice. Be of mindset to move to a more sustainable and less volatile environment. This is from Newcastle University, and it says the following. The starch risk to teeth. And interesting, because I wanted to, whenever I do a program every day, I like to see how the media is covering different things and how what they're promoting. For example, on the Food Channel and other channels dealing with food, I saw chefs competing with each other. Why, I don't know. And in effect, the debasement that your value is only if you win something, an artificial standard, you made certain dish that some chefs appreciated in 10 minutes. That's not what we should be teaching people if they want to learn how to cook. Little story. A friend of mine is David Boulay. David and his wife, I've known him for a long time. And he is arguably America's greatest chef. You won't see him on these programs. Why? Because he won't debase himself to be on a reality show that thrives on hyper stress and beating someone else to win some superficial, meaningless title. David told me a story. He worked in a restaurant when he was apprenticing and learning his craft. And he's self-taught, by the way, never went to cooking school. But that's also true for many of the great Renaissance men and women in history. It wasn't their formal education, which many didn't have, but it was their innate skills and desire to master that that made a difference. And he said that there was the owner of the restaurant, one of the most famous in Paris, took the whole team in the kitchen out to the country nearby, and they went to this person's home. It was just a farmer and very humble environment, and went in, and the farmer made him a meal. And they didn't do anything. They just were asked to watch and then enjoy the meal. And it was a very humble meal. And the owner had tears in his eyes. And he said, here we are with all of our skills and all of our interest in nouveau cuisine and our originality. And here is a man who, with the simple ingredients that he grew with his own hands, with the simple herbs and nothing fancy, he made one of the most perfect meals you've ever had. And they all agreed. David agreed. And so the idea is that the fact that we have to have something that makes us seem unique and differentiated from others, and we exaggerate norms, we exaggerate our significance, we exaggerate our pain, we exaggerate our drama, we exaggerate our crisis, we live in crisis because the exaggeration of that crisis gets other people's attention and gets people wanting to rescue us, when the game is, come into my web of story and I will show you why I deserve my pain and you deserve to try to rescue me. I will not be rescued and you will fail, but that's the game. Imagine Lady Gaga having to get people's attention by wearing an animal skin, you know, the meat dress. Did she care about what it felt like to be the animals that were slaughtered just so that she could show how insecure she is? Did she need to have, a foot-high platform shoes? Did Madonna? Now, it's not to question what talent they may or may not have and to what degree. Is that go back in time for a moment. Just imagine seeing Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland. You didn't see all this fireworks. You didn't see all these sexualized dancers. You just saw a person coming out on a stage and performing and knocking your socks off. They had that raw quality that they finally honed, and we had the ability to appreciate it. Even when they got older, even when they might forget a lyric, like Sinatra did once at Madison Square Garden, it didn't matter. You liked him. You liked all these people. They had what I call the it factor. The it factor. The person that has the it factor in a room will be the person that somehow you're drawn to, the conversation you're interested in. Could you imagine if someone says, well, Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, you've done 10 films together. That's how many they did. Or I think about a 12-year period. That's enough. We need to kill you off to keep our audience interested. So they kill off Fred Astaire, or they kill off Ginger Rogers. Well, they just killed the it factor. Even in Singing in the Rain, who was the star of Singing in the Rain? Who? You're going to say Gene Kelly? Not my opinion. Nor Debbie Reynolds? No, it's Donald O'Connor. Watch how many times when he's on the screen, you look at him, even when they're dancing together, and they're both great dancers, but Kelly was a masculine dancer. He didn't have that fluidity. Connor did, but Connor also had the personality. He had the it factor. And we don't appreciate that some people have an it factor. Well, what if you don't, and you're a performer? Then you got to do something that exaggerates your significance. And it's this constant need for exaggeration, constant need to remind people of your significance, the essentialness of them supporting you. And I just read a thing in the paper about the Kardashians, and that what they do, the constant buying and arguing and just the the voguing of them. Every single scene, they got the makeup and the hair, and then they argue with one another, and everything is about them and how they're going to profit. They don't do anything that doesn't profit them. And this is not good for people watching it. It's actual study that showed that watching them causes people to lose empathy because you get tied into the fact that maybe this is the way life should be. How do selfish, rich people who are famous live? How do they act? Remember I told you last week, I watched a segment of a program called Below the Deck. And it's not a monster yacht. It's a nice, large yacht. But they take people on. And without exception, the people that they bring on are so entitled-minded and rude. They don't care about the staff. They don't care if the staff are still there at 3 o'clock in the morning because they still want to eat it up until 3 o'clock in the morning. They don't care. They don't care about anyone except themselves. And it's just superficial trivia showing the worst of human nature. All the reality shows show the worst of human nature. I don't care whether it's the housewives of, you know, Orange County or basketball wives, every single one of these programs, the executive producer must say, now, you got to be really mean. You got to get in people's face and curse them out. You got to be able to throw tables and chairs, throw tantrums, and never have a nice, calm, loving moment in your life. Then you'll get on the show. Because I haven't seen anything but displaying the most vulgar and the most degrading parts of human nature. And this is what we now are feasting on. It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet of candy cotton. Vacuous, and creating malnourishment for the soul. Anyhow, it was just a thought because I watched a little segment of Carnival Eats, and I couldn't believe how garbagey the food was. And yet people sitting home thinking, yeah, I want to eat that. And then people at the carnival say, yeah, this is great. It's not great. You think it's going to be great when you have your heart attack or stroke? When you're prematurely aging? When you got your prostate cancer or your breast cancer? You think it's okay then? You're going to connect the two? Your drinking and your eating and your behavior? No. People don't want to acknowledge the bad choices they've made. They want to blame someone else. They put on the victim card. And that's unfortunate because then we learn nothing. Nothing. And it keeps on. So anyhow, this reminded me of that this article from Newcastle University in the United Kingdom, the starch-risked teeth. I'm thinking, when I'm watching this last night, I'm thinking, okay, how can I fit this into the program? Well, every single item they're eating is just garbage. Garbage. This is the stuff that kills us, ages us. And yet they're praising it. You know, it's like the comedian that comes out that's not funny, and that's most of the comedians today. None of the political comedians are funny at all today. They're just vulgar and loud and obnoxious, but not funny. You got to really be smart to not be vulgar and loud and be funny. W.C. Fields was funny. The Marx Brothers were funny. Mort Saul was sardonic. We've had a lot. Dick Gregory is a longtime close friend of mine. Very funny. He didn't need to be vulgar. You didn't hear him going out there and F you and F you. That would degrade him. That would be picking the lowest fruit possible, that had already fallen and rotted. Raise the level of everything in your life and see the consequences. So this is what it's saying about starch. Quote, an examination of research on oral health commissioned by the World Health Organization has indicated that for oral health, we should stick to whole grain carbohydrates and avoid processed ones, especially if sweet. Quote, food contains different types of starchy carbohydrate with varying degrees of processing. And then it goes on to talk about how all this ends up impacting your gums and your teeth. So all those chef shows, like Man versus Food last night, and this guy, look, how he makes his money is his business. I don't know who he is. I'm not going to criticize him as a person. But let me just give you this advice, friend, or anyone listening who can reach out to him. Not once have you showed people how to eat healthy or eating something healthy. I haven't seen you eat 6 pounds of a salad. What you're consuming in a gluttonous way are foods that cause heart attacks, strokes, and cancer, brain aging, and dementia. Is that what you want for your legacy? I'm famous, I'm on television, people watch me, and I've probably led to a lot of people having disease because they're following what I do and they're coming to the restaurants to serve these humongous portions of bad food. Because if that's the legacy you intend to leave, you're doing a good job. But at some point, I hope that you step back for a moment and realize there are more things than being on television and having a well-paying career. All right? Brains of overweight people, quote, 10 years older than lean counterparts at middle age. All right, that's interesting. This is from University of Cambridge. Quote, from middle age, the brains of obese individuals display differences in white matter similar to those in lean individuals 10 years their senior, according to new research by the university. Our brains naturally shrink when we age, but scientists are increasingly recognizing that obesity, already linked to conditions such as diabetes, cancer, and heart disease, may also affect the onset and progression of brain aging. Well, we know it does. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurobiology of Aging. I work with people all the time who have aged brains. People have made some mistakes. You can't undo the mistakes in the past, but you can learn from them. And then we can reverse a lot of that aging. I just wish the executives at the Food Network, the producers of programs other than the Food Network that promote unhealthy lifestyle, unhealthy behavior, including foods, understand that sooner or later, karma comes knocking on each person's door, not when we expect and not in a way we want or desire. If that karma is a heart attack or stroke or divorce, maybe we should stop for a moment and ask ourselves, is there a better way to share information with people? I believe there is. And also, some people are on very low protein diets, not healthy. And this is from major university, Sao Paulo University in Brazil. It says, the offspring of females fed a low protein diet during pregnancy and lactation are significantly more likely to develop prostate cancer as they age. This was published in the Journal of Gerontology. So it means that you should have a really good plant-based diet where you're getting your protein from beans and nuts and seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, and tubers, a baked potato, a sweet potato, a yam. They all give you protein. But they don't overdo it, so you don't create a toxic reaction in the body, and they don't underdo it, so you're malnourished. That's the healthiest way of doing it. That's the latest on health and healing. We're halfway through our program, and we're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, I want you to hear what Samantha Bee has to say about another way, using comedy, bitter comedy, to make us aware of the plight in Yemen. And I'm going to do all I can to help make people aware that we, the United States, along with Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, we're responsible for all the death and destruction in Yemen. And this is of a massive scale, massive. 22 million people in Yemen are at risk of dying. Hundreds are dying every day, especially children. So doesn't it need to be said that we should ask our government, our legislators, stop this participation? We don't care that Saudi Arabia pays these military-industrial complex agencies and contractors for planes and munitions. You're killing innocent people. We shouldn't be destroying a country that was already the poorest in the Middle East. We shouldn't do this. You shouldn't do this and think you're doing it in our name. This is not democracy. And yet this is that massive metastasizing cancer I've been telling you about for decades, that does feel they can do this with impunity, that we the people are to be governed by the standards that these oligarchs and technocrats believe in. And if we fight them, if we argue with them in any way, challenge their behavior, we are then enemies of the state, to be watched, to be ridiculed, to be mocked, to be destroyed. That is where we're at now. So we're going to take a brief break and come right back into her telling you, Samantha Bee, telling you about Yemen.
Of dark secrets, such as whatever happened to the other two Cinnamon Toast Crunch bakers? What did you do to your brother, Chef Wendell? I can see it in your eyes that it was bad. No, America's best kept secret is what we're doing in Yemen. I did my best to find out exactly what's going on. We're so worried about a possible war with North Korea that we've forgotten that we're already involved in a war in Yemen. And that war is the worst man-made humanitarian disaster in history. Ugh, I need a snack for my favorite off-brand 7-Eleven.
Hi. Hi, Sam. You look awful. You look like you're having a bad day.
Yeah, I am. Can I just get the usual?
Of course. Here you go.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Delicious. You're from Yemen, right?
Yes, I am.
Do you have family in Yemen, right?
I do have family. I have a bunch who lives in Yemen. They're dying to see my kids. They haven't seen them because the war started. People are hungry. People are suffering. People are dying. I mean, looking at the babies every morning, checking if there is anything about Yemen and our media. And I'm slowly hurting when I didn't see anything. And there's a big thing happening in Yemen.
Nobody talks about it. I'm so mad I want to freeze all your bananas. I need to learn more about Yemen. So I asked Senator Chris Murphy, one of maybe 8 Americans who knows a lot about the subject, to meet me at my new war crimes briefing room, the Dubliner. Why is this a passion for you?
The United States is participating in the murder of civilians somewhere on this earth. And everybody in this country shouldn't accept that.
It's 2018. Welcome to my comedy show. Drink up. Remind me, why are we involved in this?
The Saudis are our friend.
Okay.
And our friend has asked us for help, and so we are helping. So the United States actually sold the Saudis the planes, sold them the bombs. The problem is because they've never used them before, they're really bad at it. So we're not really sure whether they are targeting civilians inside Yemen or they're just dropping bombs on the wrong people.
What?
Yes. We have done everything other than actually pull the trigger to drop the bombs.
Do people know that?
Most Americans don't know much at all about Yemen.
The only thing Americans really know about Yemen is that Chandler pretended to move to Yemen in order to break up with Janice.
Janice was terrible.
Fair. Though not as terrible as trying to explain the war in Yemen on a comedy show, how do I put chocolate on this broccoli? Oh, I have an idea. It's Game of Thrones, it's Cake of Thrones, it's Yemen, where for 3 years a civil war has been raging for control of the country. Who's fighting? The Houthi rebels, who are financially supported by Iran, and the current Yemeni government, who is financially backed by Saudi Arabia, effectively turning Yemen into a battleground for Iran and Saudi Arabia to measure their using our yardstick. Why do I keep doing these depressing field pieces? So what is the human cost of the war in Yemen?
There are 10,000 civilians who have died either from disease or from bombing campaigns. Over 50% of the children in the country are in famine or on the verge of famine. Blockades mean that the Saudis were stopping humanitarian relief supplies from coming into the country. And bombs that were dropped hit the water treatment plants. Thus, Yemenis were drinking water laced with sewage and feces, creating an outbreak of cholera.
Who's the architect of this mess? Everybody's favorite reformer, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Coincidentally, America's number one international arms buyer. I'm sure those aren't related.
He's got a lot of friends in this town. The Saudis send a lot of money into Washington, D.C. In the end, it has an effect.
The Democrats, though, they're coming down on the right side of this, right? Like, they hate him.
MBS has a lot of Democratic friends as well as Republican friends.
MBS? Oh, my God, that sounds like an intestinal disease.
MBS, a bipartisan disease affecting almost everyone you've ever voted for or bought something from and everyone you like. Ugh. Plus, he's rounding up all the feminists in Saudi Arabia.
If the United States wasn't helping the Saudis, I think there's a question whether the Saudis would continue.
So what I'm hearing is that we're too busy constantly blowing Saudi Arabia to actually use our mouths to speak up against human rights violations.
Yeah, that's
all right. And here's some things that she and her staff did not know but could have found out. It's been proven now that the United States and our military-industrial complex, including the CIA and the Defense Department, have troops on the ground. American troops are in Yemen. And we are working with, cooperating with, Al-Qaeda. You heard it. Al-Qaeda. We're supplying them with logistics. And by the way, no, that legislator, maybe he was just not aware, but from the very beginning, the United States has controlled the logistics with reconnaissance and drones and satellites. And as a result, all the hospitals, the pharmacies, the water purification plants, the schools, the hospitals, these are all off limits. According to the Geneva Convention, in any conflict, you're not allowed to destroy civilian infrastructure or quality of life issues like water. And yet the United States has repeatedly violated every single international standard. And they knowingly are destroying those. Why? Because it's part of this old psychology that Bill and Hillary Clinton came up with, along with Madeleine Albright. And that is, if you destroy a person's capacity to have a clean drink of water, so now, as you heard him say, they're drinking feces-ridden water, and now they have the largest cholera epidemic in the world, and more babies and children are dying because they're most susceptible than any place else, plus malnutrition, and then the Saudis have a blockade, not allowing medicines or food into the country, then the people will revolt. Well, it doesn't happen that way. And proof of that is that Bill and Hillary Clinton caused a minimum of 500,000 young kids to die. Why? Freedom of Information Act documents that I was the first radio program in America to report showed that the Pentagon intentionally took out the electrical grid, the water purification systems, hoping that the population would rise up against Saddam Hussein. Didn't happen. 500,000 kids, a half a million kids, that's genocide, happened. Madeleine Albright actually defended that on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl. She's now one of the leaders of the new Democrats, right, where you're allowed to use the word socialism, but just don't implement it because none of the corporate Democrats and liberals have ever engaged in socialism in their life. These are hard, right corporate vultures. They embraced capitalism. They couldn't spell Marxism. They couldn't spell socialism. They couldn't spell anything other than greed. That, Gordon Gekko and them, are identical. So we're there because of regime change. We're there because of resources. We're there because Saudi Arabia has spent hundreds of billions of dollars, and we want that money to flow. Is there ever a question about when the current prince allows women to be beaten, flogged, killed, or beheaded because they were forcibly raped? And the culture of misogyny in many countries of the world, including Saudi Arabia, is women have no power, where they'll take a gay up and blindfold them, tie their hands behind their back, and throw them off a building. And it's a spectacle. They're not doing this in hiding. They're doing it in plain sight. When was the last time you heard any American diplomat call out when it came to this? When did you hear Netanyahu called out when he talked before Congress? And they got a standing ovation, and every member of Congress had to sign a pledge to defend Israel no matter what. And look at that. So we are nothing if not a nation of hypocrites. I just wanted to bring it to your attention so you know what's going on and you can pass the word around. Now, I'm going to hold my report on fluoride till tomorrow because there are a couple things I want you to hear. These are very important. And by the way, the film you just saw was out of sync for a reason. There was massive cursing throughout the film. And as a result, we edit the film, but when you edit it, you can't get it back into sync. if I left everything in that she was saying, we couldn't have played it. So that's why. But now you're going to see something in sync, and we're going to have a medical doctor. Not only is he a medical doctor, he's next medical doctor for the government. He's an MD, PhD, and he is going to tell you something that we need to know, especially when we heard yesterday that the Attorney General of Florida, a person you might see on Fox all the time, actually went against the legalization of medical marijuana. I mean, where are these Republicans at, and where are the Democrats? All drugs should have been legalized for the obvious reasons. Oxham theory. Let's go down the reasons why we should have no war on drugs. A, you could eliminate the Department of the DEA. B, we could save about $40 billion a year. We could also save a lot of innocent people's lives in Mexico and through Central America and Honduras and El Salvador and Colombia. Hundreds of thousands killed, many in the most gruesome way, beheaded and boiled alive, and all because of the war on drugs. And for every person killed who is involved in the war on drugs by selling, distributing, there's upwards of 10 civilians killed at the same time. So, we then empower with enormous amounts of money the cartels. Now, on top of that, you now have politicians thinking, I'm going to get that the socialist vote by saying no walls. Okay, let's just say you have no barrier, no walls. Anyone who wants to come into America for any reason can come right across, come right in. You can't stop them. They're allowed in. That means also you're going to have to allow all the gang members from MS-13 and over 173 other gangs, also organized crime, which are not gangs. These are organized crime. Over 51 different organized crime families. And also them bringing all the young girls over that they can exploit. And the terrorist, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and at least 21 other terrorist organizations who would love to get in the United States. So just think of how irrational, unreasonable this is. If you want to have immigration reform, absolutely. If you want to have a way that speeds up this torturous process illegally of waiting 5 to 20 years to get in, we should do away with that and come up with something that's responsible and reasonable for the people. We should have centers that teach English so people are not, so they're bilingual. We should have housing for them where they have a place to live so they're not made susceptible to people who would exploit them in the United States. We should have a minimum wage in the farms and subsidize it so that when they're working on a farm, they have rights that could be unionized. There's a lot we could do to allow people in this country who could then appreciate the fact that they're in this wonderful country and not be victimized. But if you think for political and ideological reasons we should just open up our borders, just understand the consequences. It's easy to say something. They never apologize. They never walk it back. Come with me. Come with me. I'll take you to Mexico. Come with me and let me interview the families whose children have been abducted, kidnapped, and forcibly brought across the desert so they can be pimped out in the United States. Listen to their stories and ask yourself, is that what you want on a massive scale? You would have millions of people coming in, some nice people, a lot that have ulterior motives. And don't forget the gangs. And if you doubt me, then those who believe in open borders, why don't you ask all the people, and no walls, why don't you ask all the people in Hollywood to tear down their walls and get rid of their armed police and bodyguards? When they go out in public, they shouldn't fear anyone. We don't fear people. And why don't we resettle all these people who from Hollywood, instead of going to Hollywood, why don't we resettle them in Southwest Los Angeles or Newark? That's a part of America. American citizens there. Do they fear them? Do they disdain them? Is it a class system? Oh, there's no red carpets in these communities. I forgot. If we put a red carpet down the street and had hairstylists and people who actually tell you what to say and how to say it and how to articulate it because you're such functional illiterates, oh, but you thought just because you were famous and making $20 million a film that somehow you can virtue posture, tell us what to believe, but you're not going to hold the same standards. That's where we're at this moment. Now listen to this government official, ex-government official, tell you about drugs. We shouldn't have a war on drugs.
Yes, we know that for a fact. That's been shown over and over again in laboratories, petri dishes, animals. And increasingly, we've started to have generate case reports with real good objective markers. It's just because of the view of cannabis as a Schedule I dangerous substance with no accepted safety for medical use under supervision, which is the official position of the federal government. It's a politically unpopular thing to study cannabinoids killing cancer cells in the 70s, and now it continues to be a politically unsupported thing to study cannabis killing cancer cells in the 2010s. And that's got to change, because there is tremendous potential, and not only that, for palliation for cancer patients too, boosting appetite, relieving pain, improving mood, reducing nausea and vomiting, easing pain. Those are all serious things that cancer patients face, and other treatments that they could help their cancer, they don't take or are take less of because of those different symptoms. So supporting, palliating cancer patients, and then potentially even helping them fight the cancer, these things are being called for by leading cancer researchers, and thankfully now on the cancer.gov National Cancer Institute website, as of latter part of January of 2016, they have included some of these case report citations and many more details about how cannabis and cannabinoids can help in cancer. I was proud to have been a part of the editorial advisory board to put those revisions in, and I'm hoping that as we gain this knowledge, we'll also gain the courage to see where it leads us.
Think of that for a moment. It's not about the science. The science is there. The cannabinoids help with seizures, with lung cancer, with brain cancers, with autoimmune conditions, with Lyme's disease, but the political power is not. So we need to share information about the real science of healing with cannabinoids and stop this stupid war on drugs. Do you think that we would have had 37 shootings and whatever number of deaths were in Chicago just over the weekend if we had no profiting from the war on drugs, if we put up treatment centers, humanistic treatment centers, rehabilitation centers, gang rehabilitation centers, creating jobs with living wages in the communities, by the communities, controlled by the communities? Do you think it would be a different place? You bet it would be. But that takes political will. And we don't have that at this moment, and we should. Now I'm going to show you about an Australian police. And this is rare, when someone breaks that blue wall to come forward and tell you the truth, because what he's telling you, I have friends, many friends, detectives, police officers, and they tell this story over and over again, that what the commissioner and the politicos at the top tell you is almost always distortions the truth. And I was actually in a car waiting for a friend to get out of a dental office. And I was there because there was a meter. So I made sure that there was money in the meter, and I'm sitting in the car, but I'm leaning back. And so I'm not sitting up. I'm just resting and just thinking. And I look in the side view mirror, and I saw this cop coming up the street. And every single car he was given a ticket to. So he came up, and he was writing a ticket, and I jumped out of the car, and I said, "Hold on, officer, look at the meter. The meter still has 15 minutes. And look at all these other meters." And I walked down. Not a single one of those ones he just ticketed. And he just shrugged his shoulders and kept going. That is normal, absolute, everyday behavior in New York City. But it's also the true all over the United States. Asset forfeiture, stopping people, taking their cars, taking their businesses, taking their homes. $4.3 billion they stole, the police stole from innocent civilians, not to arrest them, not to give them a ticket. "Well, we think you were using drugs," they say to a 78-year-old woman and her sister driving. "We don't do drugs." "Well, we think there are, so all your money comes to us." In Oklahoma, it was even bad. It was worse. They actually would take your identification and all your bank cards and stick them into a little portable machine and draw out all the money from your bank accounts into theirs. Wow. And where was the uproar? None. Listen to this guy now.
When I joined SAPOL, I thought it was a job with honour. Protecting the community, catching the bad guys, putting the scumbags behind bars, making people safe in their homes. But it's not like that. We're tax collectors. This goes to the very top. It goes to headquarters. It's a culture. It comes from the commissioner and trickles down.
It's the sound we hate, even when we're right. When it comes to court, it's your word against the constabulary, and no guess whose word the court is more likely to believe.
The light was green when I turned the corner, and there's no way that light was red.
These are confidential, top-level police emails, not seen by the public until tonight. They come from inspector ranks, written proof that police have official targets, that cops are obliged to book a minimum number of fellow South Australians, whether they've committed a crime or not. Here's one from a regional service commander.
I now require a report from each team sergeant and officer in charge of each station, how they plan to achieve their weekly benchmarks. I do not want a list of excuses. I require your plans as to how you will achieve this task.
We'd go out to deliberately provoke somebody. We'd go outside a pub or a nightclub, approach somebody, try and stir them up, try and provoke them. And if we got the required reaction, we'd grab them.
SAPOL officers are required to get 380 cannabis expiation notices.
By law, we've got to have reasonable grounds to search somebody.
But police will go through pockets, handbags, where they have no grounds.
This is illegal. These are illegal searches. We're breaking the law.
Drivers are most vulnerable, even when there's no road safety issue involved.
We'd waited a stop sign for what we call a rolling stop. The car had to move only a couple of inches, just the barest minimum. We'd ping them.
Basically, you know that means you've got to get out there and bring in the loot for the government.
It's working. Government wants us to speed. It's in the budget. Labor banks on fining us $145 million a year, and fines cost 2 to 3 times more here than in, say, Queensland, even for non-safety issues like not showing a P-plate or the easier gotcha, tow balls that partially obscure a number plate.
This is part of the strategy that's been pushed down by government onto the police department to bring in as much money as they possibly can.
Owen Godfrey is a former Star Force officer, 16 years in the force, now a road safety campaigner opposed to high fines for trivial offences.
It's easy money, and they can always couch it in terms of, well, it's about road safety, which of course they know is a load of rubbish, and police know is a load of rubbish, and it just seems that everybody's having to live this lie constantly. The road toll and road accidents have rather remained static and plateaued, or in actual fact, in a lot of cases, they have climbed.
You fell behind, you got to rocket up. This is what we call the Wooden Spoon Award. It's a competition. We have teams 1 to 5, and the team with the least amount of arrests and expiations wins the Wooden Spoon Award. Nothing to do with road safety, they cop the fine.
Just touching a white line like this one, a stiff fine. In the case of a rolling stop,
that could mean a loss of licence, a $450 fine, 3 expiation points.
This is incredibly devastating for many people whose job involves them being on the road a lot of the time. People who are salespeople, courier drivers, taxi drivers. If they lose their license, they can lose their job or lose their business, lose their homes. It sometimes affects their family situation, and a lot of the time it affects their mental health.
A spokesperson for Commissioner Grant Stevens, recently under fire for this taxpayer-funded overseas trip, admitted to Today Tonight that police have a set number of so-called benchmarks they have to meet. Last year, Bill Thomas was in the city driving with his wife. He stopped for a red light at King William Street. It turned green. He went around the corner and police were behind him.
It's got a siren on. I've got to pull over.
Bill went to court 5 times before being acquitted.
Would have been a lot cheaper for you to actually just have paid the fine.
Sure, but there's a principle too. You want to clear your name. And yes, sure, I could have taken the easy way out. and paid $487 and had a driving record.
Bill's case was widely talked about within SAPOL. Last week, Bill was at a service club when a stranger approached.
And he said, I'm a retired police officer. And he said, I know what happened, they're after a quota.
In the country, a police officer would know most of the people in the community. If he pulls somebody over and books him, and he knows it's unfair, there are no duels out there. From being a respected member of the community, a police officer, he's an outcast. There are a lot of decent cops. We've got to make targets, and we want to keep jobs.
Okay. I'm playing this just to show you what we will end up accepting. It seems as if there's a tolerance level. We're like the frogs in boiling water. They keep abusing us. They take away our rights and privileges. They demonize us, condemn us. Anyone who is an activist, anyone speaking out, is then marginalized. You won't see that person in the media. You won't see them getting published. And when you talk about crimes against humanity, they really have a rough time. We're here to give a forum for those people to bring us the truth, the whistleblowers and others. So I commend that police officer for telling us the truth, knowing there's going to be a blowback on him and his career. By the way, this is the same Australia that refused to allow Joan Shenton, a multi-award-winning documentarian, to show a documentary because they disagreed with her content, and didn't allow her in the country nor her film to be shown. She is not the first person. It has happened many times. That's unfortunate. I'm Gary Nolm. We're out of time now. Let me mention that tonight, an unusual progressive commentary hour, and that Richard Gale and I are going to talk about what happens to activists who speak out. The way that you are treated today by speaking out and telling the truth is horrible. Even Chris Hedges was just viciously attacked by a group that should have been applauding him. They didn't. He didn't align with them politically or ethically. 7 o'clock, PRN.FM. You won't want to miss it. Have a nice day, everyone.